The Jeffersonians take command. The election of 1800 and 1801 was peculiar. In fact, calling it the election of 1800 and 1801 denotes its peculiarity. The outcome of the presidential contest was not decided until 1801. This was the result of a tie in the Electoral College between the two Republican nominees, Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr. Parties had not been contemplated by the people who created the Article I system for selecting the president and vice president, and so an idea that there would be two candidates who had exactly the same number of electoral votes never occurred to anyone. That explains the oversight involved in saying that the first place winner in the Electoral College would become president and the second place winner would become vice president. What we had in 1800 were Republican presidential and vice presidential electors from north to south all voting for both Jefferson and Burr. This was a radically different outcome from that of 1796, in which several southern delegates to the Electoral College had thrown away their electoral votes, their second electoral votes, rather than vote for Burr, thus accounting for the fact that after John Adams as president, Thomas Jefferson was the clear choice for vice president and not tied with his supposed running mate, Aaron Burr. In 1800, on the other hand, largely because of Burr's political electioneering in New York City, the Republicans won control of the Electoral College, and here was Burr tied with Jefferson. The lame duck Congress, ironically, was going to be responsible for making the decision, because what the unamended Constitution said was that if somebody had a majority of electoral votes, the first place winner would become president and the second place winner would be vice president. So there being nobody who was the winner, the top two vote getters' names were put before the House of Representatives. And in this interim between the November clarification of the situation and the March inauguration of the president, the old outgoing Congress, recently defeated at the polls by supporters of Burr and Jefferson, was given the task of choosing between Burr and Jefferson. What's ironic about that, though, or what's a little bit further complicating of that, is that the House of Representatives did not vote each member with one vote, but instead by states, so that small states were equal to large states, and what the winner needed, what was needed to win, was for somebody to have a majority of state delegations. There went through Congress 36 different ballots before finally choice of Thomas Jefferson was made, and apparently this may have headed off revolution, or at least an insurrection, because both the Republican governor of Pennsylvania and the Republican governor of Virginia were prepared to intervene militarily if what they took to be the people's choice, that is, that Jefferson should become president, were thwarted by the defeated Federalists in the Congress. So Jefferson's good friend, former law student, James Monroe, was recently installed as Virginia's governor, and he did not intend for the Republicans' victory to be snatched from them by any kind of machinations between defeated Federalists, discredited Federalists, and Vice President to be Burr. So Jefferson ultimately was the winner, and questions have dogged this outcome ever since. According to some accounts, the sole congressman from Delaware had made an agreement with Jefferson's representatives that he would switch his vote and support Jefferson, that is, cast Delaware's vote for Jefferson, if Jefferson agreed not to purge the administration of Federalists, not to eliminate the Navy, and to keep the National Bank. Jefferson ever after denied that he had made any such deal, but note that to the consternation of Republicans who, as Virginia Congressman William Branch Giles put it, were looking forward to a pretty thorough removal of Federalists from appointed positions, Jefferson actually did keep all three of those planks of what was supposed to have been a deal between the Delaware congressman and him. Jefferson's first inaugural can be seen, or the events surrounding his inauguration can be seen as a constitutional moment too. Nowadays we take for granted that if Bush is leaving office and Obama is replacing him, or if Carter is leaving office and Reagan is succeeding him, there won't be violence, there won't be overthrow of the government, the generals won't step in and perpetuate the rule of the outgoing president. But although in theory this was the way things were supposed to work in 1801, in practice it hadn't happened before. So one couldn't take for granted that John Adams would do what he did, which was to leave peacefully. In fact, he left in the morning of Inauguration Day, March 4th, 1801, without communicating to Jefferson any kind of sentiments. He just got into a carriage and rode out of town. Jefferson, in his inaugural address, made clear that he understood the constitutional situation in the same way as Adams did, and again, that this was going to be a peaceful transition. So he said in his inaugural address that there would be no retribution on the defeated Federalists. In fact, he said that they should stand as monuments to the safety with which error can be tolerated when reason is left free to combat it. And that was his way of saying that in America there weren't going to be shootings and hangings and poisonings of defeated foes, but instead people who lost the election had just lost the election, and now their reputations were ruined by the fact that, as he understood it, they had stood against the American consensus. Jefferson did think there was a consensus, and in fact he hoped and expected that political parties would cease to exist. As far as he was concerned, the political contention of the 1790s, which had verged on violence much of the time, had been overwrought, that is, had been excessive and out of the ordinary, and that was not the way that American civic life should be conducted. So Jefferson hoped that parties would cease to exist, and he made this clear by saying in his inaugural address that we have called by different names brethren of the same principle. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. Often this is seen as merely a political statement, but really it was a constitutional one. The question whether a written document would guide people in a peaceful transition from one party controlling the chief executive's position to another party's control of the chief executive's position remained, as the lawyers say, to be liquidated, and here it was being liquidated. Here it was being borne out that people had put their trust in constitutional forms and validly expected that this would be the way that America's leading politicians would handle these kinds of developments. When Jefferson's people came into control of the Congress, along with control of the White House, and Jefferson was the first president to live his full term in the White House, as Adams had only moved into it in the last few weeks of his presidency, the judiciary was the remaining redoubt of Federalist power. And of course, Article 3 of the Constitution provided that American federal judges would have, in general, would have good behavior tenure. That was the Constitution's phrase, quote unquote, good behavior tenure. And so here were these people who, in the lead up to the presidential and congressional elections of 1800, had behaved in what today would seem to people to be a rankly partisan way. There was not yet the same kind of ethic of disengagement on the part of judges as we take for granted now. So the question arose what kind of steps the new Republican majority in Congress could take to rein in Federalist judges. One answer was to repeal the Judiciary Act of 1801. This was legislation that had been passed by the Federalist Congress in the waning days of the Adams administration and in the waning days of Federalist control of Congress. It had created several new federal courts and had created a lot of lower level federal appointive quasi-judicial or judicial positions, such as that of Justice of the Peace in the District of Columbia, which is going to be an important position, not so much for its power, but for a lawsuit it would later be involved in. Anyway, The repeal of the Judiciary Act of 1801 seemed to the Republican majority foreordained, an obvious response to what they took to be the partisan behavior of the judiciary in the Adams administration. Not only that, but this Judiciary Act of 1801 had been passed in time to allow President Adams to appoint numerous partisan Federalists to these jobs in his outgoing weeks. So there came to be a kind of stereotype, or I guess I should say caricature, of Adams' behavior in his last days that centered on the image of what were called the Midnight Judges. So the idea was that Adams spent his last few weeks, evenings as president, sitting up late at night, filling out commissions so that people who had been appointed to these new life tenured positions would be in place to help to thwart the will of the Republican majority. I use the word Republican both in terms of the Republican Party and in terms of the electoral majorities that had put the new congressional majorities in power. Now, what repeal of the Judiciary Act of 1801 involved was eliminating a lot of these positions from existence, and there would be contention over that. Several people in the federal judiciary, including even Chief Justice John Marshall, believed that the elimination of these Article III judgeships was unconstitutional. That is, on one hand, Republicans said, well, yes, you have life tenure, you have good behavior tenure, but that assumes the existence of your court. If we legislate your court out of existence, then the question of your tenure is moot. And for their part, the Federalists said among themselves that, no, you couldn't get around the good behavior tenure provision by just saying we're going to eliminate the court. And several of them, apparently, including Marshall, thought that the repeal was unconstitutional insofar as it got rid of positions to which people had already been appointed. But ultimately, the Federalists in the federal judiciary decided that discretion was the better part of valor and opted not to do anything about the fact that the Republicans had repealed the Judiciary Act. They decided to go along. Jefferson took other steps in his early days in office to clarify the Republican meaning of the Constitution. One was to pardon people who had been convicted under the Sedition Act, that is, people who had been convicted of seditious libel, the now statutory crime of saying things that tended to bring the federal government into ill repute. The Jeffersonians had argued that this was an unconstitutional provision of law, both on the basis of a Tenth Amendment point that there was nothing in the Constitution that said Congress should could pass such a law, and on the First Amendment point that it tended to violate people's freedoms of speech, press, and assembly. So Jefferson pardoned the people who had been convicted under the Sedition Act and returned their fines to them. Besides that, there was also a dispute within the Republican majority over the question how to respond to what seemed to the Republicans to have been a course of Federalists in the 1790s of wantonly and flagrantly avoiding and violating the Constitution. Two prominent figures from Jefferson's home state of Virginia, sometime past and future, U.S. Senator John Taylor of Caroline County, and his uncle and patron, besides very prominent Virginia state-level politician himself, Edmund Pendleton, proposed a suite of amendments. And they said that it had been unconstitutional in the 1790s for Congress to pass a bank bill, for the president to issue a neutrality proclamation, and so on. And yes, these measures, to pass a Sedition Act, and yes, these measures now had been effectively negated, or at least ultimately would be negated by the fact of Republicans' ascendancy in Congress, but there was no reason to think that the Republican ascendancy would be permanent. And so they proposed amending the Constitution to make clear that such measures were prohibited in future. Ultimately, however, Jefferson decided not to take this advice and not to push for amendments to the Constitution, apparently on the basis of James Madison, his Secretary of State, who had the idea that people needed to be taught to revere the Constitution, which had already been amended 11 times by the time Jefferson became president. So Jefferson passed on this opportunity to clarify, not only in politics but in the Constitution, that the Republican position was the American position. Of course, what this did was leave an opening for later presidents and Congresses to violate the same provisions, more or less in the same ways, over and over and over. So the position that Taylor and Pendleton took, that there needed to be amendments forever, rendering the Federalist preferences moot, this has been vindicated by American history. Another kind of constitutional initiative that was taken by the Republicans in the early days of their control of the federal government were a couple of impeachments of federal judges. The first of these impeachments, the Pickering impeachment, involved a federal district judge from New Hampshire who had come into ill repute. The reason was that it seemed to people that he was perpetually drunk on the bench. And so ultimately he was impeached by the House of Representatives and went to trial in the Senate. In his trial in the Senate, the House manager said that the problem was that Pickering was drunk. This incapacitated him and he ought to be removed from office. The defense counsel for Pickering offered a couple of counterarguments. First, they submitted into evidence a letter from Judge Pickering's son saying, "My father's not a drunk, actually he's senile." And secondly, they said, "Well, drunk or senile, neither one of these is a high crime or misdemeanor." Well, that was the language that the Constitution used in conferring the impeachment power on the Congress, that it could impeach high executive or judicial officials for treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. And if being drunk or senile on the bench were not a high crime or misdemeanor, well, then they couldn't be removed by the Senate. Now, of course, the implication here was incorrect, because in English law, which is whence we get the phrases high crimes and high misdemeanors, it was actually a high misdemeanor for an official to be incapacitated. So if you had a mental breakdown, or if you lost your mind, or if you were incapacitated in some way, or if you had a habit like being drunk on a regular basis, these were all high misdemeanors for which you could be removed from office. But the counsel for Judge Pickering asserted that no, this referred to matters for which you could be indicted, and you couldn't be indicted for being drunk or for being senile, they said. The Senate ultimately removed Judge Pickering from office, but they didn't explain the ground on which they had done that. And the question of the meaning of these phrases, high crimes and high misdemeanors, would echo over and over and over through the history of American impeachments, even all the way down to the present. It hasn't really been made clear what the Senate's understanding of this phrase is. Too often, however, senators have fallen back on the idea that anything that's not indictable is not a high crime or a high misdemeanor, which, again, is clearly invalid. Having removed Judge Pickering from office, the Republican majority in the Congress decided it had bigger fish to fry and next turned its guns on Justice Samuel Chase. Justice Chase became the only Supreme Court justice in American history to be impeached. And this was a surprising conclusion to the political activity of somebody who had been a founding father and had been an important congressman during the Revolution, and then had been an important participant in Maryland's ratification debates, and finally, after having been an anti-federalist in that scenario, had switched sides and become a Washington supporter. Anyway, Chase was impeached by the House of Representatives for abusing his office. And this centered on, among other things, what was called the Colander Affair. James Thompson Colander was a muckraking journalist who had published a lot of negative things about Federalists in the 1790s. And as far as Justice Chase was concerned, without really knowing anything about the individual, this amounted to a violation of the Sedition Act. So, riding circuit in Maryland, Justice Chase told people that the author of this book, and he had a book that Collender had written attacking President Adams, is going to be indicted when I reach Richmond. He's then going to be tried, and he's going to be convicted, at which point he's going to get the maximum sentence. Okay, well, clearly this is not the kind of judge anyone wants, somebody who's already decided he's going to give him the maximum sentence before there's even been an indictment and said so. But when he reached Richmond, Justice Chase lived up to all of these prognostications, and Collender was thrown in prison and given a substantial fine for violating the Sedition Act. Well, all of this seemed obviously to deprive Collender of due process of law and to run counter to the idea of the right to trial by jury in criminal cases, which the Constitution guarantees. So Chase was impeached by the House of Representatives. Unfortunately, the House then chose not a skilled attorney as its manager of the impeachment case in the Senate, but a congressman from Virginia, Thomas Jefferson's very eccentric cousin, John Randolph of Roanoke. And Randolph, by most accounts, bungled the presentation of this case to the Senate. But the chief sticking point, once again, was this question of indictability. The House managers, of course, had insisted that, well, if this wasn't an abuse of office, what was? And yet, ultimately, the justice was acquitted. When Jefferson heard about this result in the Senate trial of Justice Chase, he said, essentially, well, that just proves that impeachment is worthless. If you couldn't remove this fellow, whom could you remove? And the House had to give up on what may have been plans to go after Chief Justice Marshall next. I'd note that, in my own opinion, the acquittal of Justice Chase is the worst, the most deleterious jury outcome in American history. It's the worst trial result in terms of its ramifications, essentially insulating people on the federal judiciary from any kind of consequences for abusing their positions for political purposes. And now we take for granted, more or less, that unless a federal judge is a felon and actually in prison, and there have been cases in the 1980s, two cases where federal district court judges were convicted of felonies, and one guy was in prison for months receiving his federal judicial salary before finally his Senate trial concluded. Unless that happens, it's virtually impossible to remove a federal judge from office using the impeachment power. Clearly, this is not the way the impeachment power was originally understood, not the way it ought to work, but that's what the outcome of the Chase impeachment case meant.